One of the best things that happened as a consequence of the 16th century Reformation was that the Bible was placed in the hands of the individual. The Bible was placed in the hands of the individual who can then read the Bible for themselves. So that was a very good thing. But the bad thing was that not everybody knew how to read the Bible. Not everybody knew how to make sense of things, how to interpret things, and so on. So that was the bad side of this movement. And I think the reason why the reason why this is important to me is because God, in a Christian worldview, God gives us revelation. He doesn't give us a theology that we just have a set of doctrines and we believe it. No, he gives us revelation. We still have to contrive some sort of theology from his revelation by methods of interpretation. So I think that's why this is a pretty important thing to look at. And therefore tonight I just want to look at Bible reading and Bible interpretation, but more than just that, how to read the Bible and interpret the Bible in a meaningful way. And I think on one level, I think it, you can say on in one way that you don't have to be a Christian to read the Bible in a meaningful way, in some sense, I think. And so if someone might be skeptical about the Bible or Christianity, you probably already know that the Bible has a special place amongst all other books for a Christian, and therefore Bible reading is of great significance to Christians in general. And well, you might meet someone who really finds the Bible very strange, a very strange and absurd kind of book. And I guess on one level, I will admit that there are some crazy stories in the Bible. There's some very things that's very difficult. There's some things that's very difficult to make sense of, and there's just things in there that might be downright awkward or weird or something like that. So I really acknowledge that. But I guess there's many reasons for someone to dismiss the Bible, but I think one of them that's not a good reason for dismissing the Bible is because it's not interesting. I think the Bible is probably one of the most interesting and most mysterious books you'll ever read. I mean, Jordan Peterson, who as far as I know is not a Christian, he has an immense respect for the Bible and an immense interest in the Bible. He, for example, says this: "Why bother with this strange book at all? That's a good question. It's outlasted kingdoms, many, many kingdoms. It's really interesting that a book is more durable than stone. It's more durable than a castle. It's more durable than an empire, and that is really interesting." He also says this: referring to the new atheists like Richard Dawkins and so on, they're not approaching the thing, referring to the Bible, with enough respect. What I've tried to do is to think that there is probably more to this than I know, and then try to understand it from that perspective, rather than to think, for example, well, it's a collection of superstitions that we've somehow outgrown. No, sorry, that's just not a deep enough analysis. And then he makes this one last comment, which I would like to read. "It seems that there is all this work," and he's again referring to the Bible, "there's all this work, and it seems that we've left it to decay in the dust, and it's a big mistake, man." That's what Jordan Peterson says. So after all, the Bible is the most translated, most read, and most printed book in history. And there must be some reason for this. So if someone is skeptical about the Bible, I think there's still reasons for investigating it. There's still enough reasons out there to look at it, to read it. And maybe I can just quickly give make 3 points that I think is good to remember when reading the Bible and you might be struggling with making sense of it or buying into absolutely everything. So just take these 3 principles. First one is, maybe consider the possibility that the Bible doesn't teach what you think it does. For example, polygamy. There are many instances in the Bible where great heroes of the faith were polygamists. But if you read the Bible carefully, I think, it never teaches polygamy, in fact. What some of these instances rather point out is that the consequences of polygamy, it wreaks havoc. So it doesn't teach polygamy in a positive way, but it points out what the consequences socially, emotionally, and maybe psychologically and all these things, but it points out those horrible consequences. So that's just an example, but consider the possibility that the Bible doesn't teach what you think it does. Then consider the possibility that you don't understand what the Bible teaches because of your own cultural blinders, maybe. An example like that might be slavery. If we, in our modern world, if we hear the word slavery, we usually think, our minds directly jump to New World slavery from the 17th, 18th century. Where it was the slaves came from Africa, it was definitely race-based slavery and so on. So we have that concept of slavery in our minds. And I would also maybe challenge someone to read the Bible on the passages where it talks about slavery, and maybe, just maybe, the Bible's view of slavery wasn't that view of slavery that we have experienced during those couple of centuries. And then thirdly, please remember that the Bible might sometimes offend you because of an unexamined assumption that you have about the superiority of your own cultural moment. For example, an individualistic Western culture will read the Bible and they might have a very negative experience of the Bible when it limits you in some way, when it places some sort of limit on you regarding sexuality or some other things in life. But then on the other hand, a Western culture would love what the Bible has to say about forgiveness and love your neighbor and these kind of things. So that might be a cultural tendency. But then if you take the Bible to the Middle East, it might be the other way around, that they like what they read about sexuality or gender and so on in the Bible, but they don't like this sort of just love your enemy, forgive everyone, and so on. They don't like that very much. So that's just another example that I think might help. But again, like I said, I don't think you have to be a Christian to read the Bible in a meaningful way. So look at the Bible and don't let it decay in the dust, like Jordan Peterson said. Now, on the other hand, if you are a Christian, you would probably not be surprised to discover that Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons interpret many Bible passages differently than the way that you were taught to understand certain passages. I mean, Mormons use Jesus' words to Philip in John 14, where Jesus says, "Whoever has seen me has seen the Father," to say that God the Father has a physical body with flesh and bones, like we do. The Jehovah's Witnesses use 1 Corinthians 14, verse 33, to arrive at the conclusion that the doctrine of the Trinity is false. And we read the following there: "For God is not a God of confusion, but of peace." The Trinity, according to them, is a doctrine of confusion. God is not a God of confusion, and therefore the Trinity is false. If you're a Protestant, then you would probably not be surprised to discover that Protestants and Catholics differ in their understanding of the meaning of many different Bible passages. You also probably would not be surprised that many Protestants disagree with themselves or each other about many biblical passages. In fact, interpretations often differ among people in the same church, the same Sunday school class, or even in the same family. I mean, I personally like some things that John Calvin had to say about certain biblical passages, while my wife thinks he's an idiot. Well, no, she didn't say that, but she would rather not. She doesn't agree with John Calvin on everything. So, what you also find in many times on Facebook and social media is just these one-line verses that would be thrown out there to make some sort of statement. Consider, for example, "Judge not that you be not judged. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Passages like this. Now the question is, how can these different interpretations be explained? And not just that, how should the Bible verses be used then, if these one-line verses might not always be a good representation of the verse itself? Maybe someone who differed with you over some biblical interpretation of something have once told you, you don't have to interpret the Bible, just read it, believe it, and do what it says. Or maybe someone once said to you, remember though, that that is just your interpretation. These might sound like good sentiments, but I don't think it's true. Nobody escapes the act of interpretation, and I for one think that we can, or at least should strive, to arrive at an objectively correct interpretation of the biblical text. And let me just say this real quick. I know that some of these different interpretations, they lie on different levels. It might be small differences about a verse here and there, which only leads to small or minor implications and beliefs and lifestyles and so on. But it might also be big differences with big implications for your beliefs and lifestyle. So if you think about certain ethical debates in our modern culture, and I'm thinking particularly about the debate surrounding homosexuality, in the Christian churches or in Christian circles, everybody on the different sides of this debate wants the Bible on their side. You have the one side who might be against it, and then you have the other side who's for it, but both sides would claim that their conclusions is the correct conclusion drawn from a correct interpretation of the Bible. I mean, I was in a lecture at the theological faculty at TIPS on Monday, where there was a European professor, Old Testament professor, presenting a lecture on homosexuality, where he argued for the legitimacy of homosexuality from the Old Testament. And he, for example, alluded to Jonathan and David being a homosexual couple, and so on. But the point that I'm trying to make is he's got some sort of interpretation of the Old Testament there, and there would be many other Old Testament theologians who would wholeheartedly disagree with him. But a difference on some of these topics might have bigger consequences than it has, than differences on other levels might have. So we need to maybe just keep that in mind. And then, of course, when it comes to churches and their leaders in South Africa, we have seen it all, from followers being sprayed with doom to eating rats or snakes because the Bible somehow asks it of us. For example, Prophet Letebu Rabalakho, also known as the Doom Pastor of Mount Zion General Assembly Church, and he made the headlines in 2016 after pictures surfaced on Facebook of him spraying doom on his congregants. And according to News 24, he claimed the act of spraying doom was to heal his followers and to cast out demons. Prophet Shepherd Bushiri, also called the Major One. Last year, Prophet Bushiri of the Enlightenment Christian Gathering shocked us when he sold tickets for a gala dinner in his honor at the Pretoria showgrounds, and these tickets were for sale for anything between 1,000 and 25,000 rand. The closer you wanted to sit to the prophet, the more you had to pay. Pastor Hamilton Nolo from KwaZulu-Natal, he said he claimed that he was capable of curing homosexuality and HIV. And his claims got media personality, this guy Lerato Khanyahu, really worked up because he said the following, "What irks me the most is that they keep taking from the poor." And then one last example, maybe Prophet Nguni. Prophet Nguni of the End Times Disciples Ministries in Shoshanguve, Pretoria, he's well known for feeding snakes and rats to his congregants. And according to ENCA, the 24-year-old pastor also claimed to have turned his church members into snakes. And then he also asked some of his members to get naked before praying to him. Now, I'm not saying that all of these practices is the conclusion of very specific interpretations of the Bible, but I don't think that the Bible has nothing to do with it. So just keep that in mind. Bible, certain interpretations of the Bible can lead to certain practices in churches. Another example that I have for you is from the Dake Annotated Reference Bible. Now listen to his conclusion. This conclusion that is drawn from the Bible concerning certain attributes of God and also the nature of God. God has a personal spirit body, a shape, a form, image and likeness of a man. He has bodily parts such as back parts, hands and fingers, mouth, lips and tongue, feet, eyes, ears, hair, head, face, arms, and other bodily parts. Now, if you look at this quote, as it is written directly in the Dake Annotated Bible reference, then there's also many passages in brackets to support these claims that you'll find in this quote. For example, to make the claim that God has ears, we can read Psalm 18, verse 6, which reads, "In my distress I called upon the Lord, to my God I cried for help. From his temple he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears." And so for each one of these characteristics or features of God, they would have a verse stated in brackets there for his lips, tongue, arms, fingers, and hands, and so on. So, of course, it must be the case that God has these bodily parts, just like the Bible says, right? But how do we square these passages with other passages like John 4, verse 24, which says God is spirit, and Luke 24, verse 39, "For a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have." And then just one last point, maybe, to bring the seriousness of interpretation within a Christian worldview home, you can read a passage like 2 Peter 3, verse 14 to 17, which states, "There are some things in them," and he's referring to the letters of Paul, "there are some things in them that are hard to understand, which the ignorant and unstable twist to their own destruction, as they do the other scriptures." Now, if I interpret this verse correctly, then I think that there is such a wrong way you can potentially interpret the Bible that it might lead to your own destruction. And I think, therefore, interpreting the Bible should be of special concern to Christians, and we should therefore wrestle with these kinds of questions. How do people reach contrary and flat-out contradictory conclusions? How can I know whether my conclusion from my interpretation is the correct one? Now, please know that Christians have been asking these questions for centuries. Theologians and philosophers through the centuries have worked hard on the practice of biblical interpretation. And not just that, they've also attempted to establish certain principles that would lead an interpreter to the correct meaning of a passage. Now, for those of you who might like the technical words, the study of biblical interpretation is called hermeneutics, and exegesis is another term that we use, which is basically the same as trying to interpret something, but it's just like, exegesis is an attempt to get meaning out of the Bible. Study the Bible and get meaning from it. And you also have to realize that many people then, of course, have written many books on this. So please don't think that we are going to cover a lot of ground tonight. We probably won't even scratch the surface, and I definitely won't be able to answer all the questions and solve all the problems that we face when we're reading the Bible. So it's a very deep topic, I think, this, and there should be more time to discuss maybe some of these things. But what I do hope to do is to give you some basic tools for trying to solve some of these things yourself. And I think some of the things that I will share tonight won't be new to many of you. Now, I just want to qualify one more thing that I mentioned earlier. On one level, we must realize that we can give each other the freedom to disagree about certain interpretations that we have about the Bible. So within Christian circles, there are things that we can disagree over, and that is fine. I mean, when it comes to the issues in Christianity that doesn't compromise the teachings and practices of the gospel, I really like what J.I. Packer has to say about this. He says, "None of us, whatever his or her own personal convictions, should feel entitled to say with absolute confidence that the Bible excludes the other way. We're in the realm not of certainties of faith, but of matters of more or less probable opinion. The most we can say is that I think the Bible excludes the other way. I think my practice is the one Scripture directs. Now, I know I can't read a quote like this without any further explanation. So if you walk out of here and think that I use this quote to say that everything goes when it comes to biblical interpretation, then you might be missing the point. He clearly makes a distinction here between certainties in matter of interpretation or doctrines and so on, and then maybe something like uncertainties. But remember that the uncertainties has its proper place, because the uncertainties are the things that we are allowed to disagree about, and it's no threat to the very existence of Christianity. That's the nature of the uncertainties that we have. So the point is that there are things that we can't be certain of. I mean, there are even parts in the Bible that we're not even certain about the correct translation of the text, what to say about the correct interpretation of the text. So I just want to say that I acknowledge that. But then there are other things that is very clear. In fact, I think it can't be any clearer sometimes. So my point is to strive to find objective meaning in the Bible, because it is there, I think. I would therefore not agree with statements like these. And all of these comes from Christians who's also wrestling with this and has written their books on hermeneutics. Duval and Hayes states that many writers have pointed out that total objectivity in interpretation is impossible, and we acknowledge this. Another one, there is no such thing as a pure reading, an objective interpretation. Total objectivity on the part of the interpreter does not exist. For one thing, I think that the statements they are making is contradictory. For some reason, they expect us to find objective meaning in what they are saying there. And the second thing is that they are guilty of the fallacy of lost distinctions, which states that when there is no correct interpretation or meaning, then there is no standard by which to distinguish any given interpretation from the correct one. Okay, but I think enough of all of this. So I want us now to look at these principles that I think is valid when reading and interpreting the Bible. And I just want to say one more thing. The basic principles which we will look at doesn't come from the Bible itself. So we are not reading the Bible to find principles for interpreting the Bible. We already have the principles for interpreting the Bible before you can arrive at any conclusion that you make from the Bible. So I've read this, for example, in another hermeneutics book. We use the Bible to derive hermeneutical principles, then we use hermeneutics to interpret the Bible. I think that's a circular statement to make. Now, please note that I'm not denying that you can use the Bible to help clarify the Bible. There are things in the Bible that can help us to clarify the Bible. For example, 2 Peter 2, verse 19, talks about the morning star rising in our hearts. This raises all sorts of questions. What is the morning star? And so on. And then if you turn to Revelation 22, verse 16, Jesus says, I am the bright morning star. So you can use the Bible, different Bible passages to help clarify other portions of the Bible which might be a little bit more difficult to understand. But I think the basic principles is things that doesn't come from the Bible itself. It's principles that you would apply to any document that you're probably going to read. If you read a philosopher from the Enlightenment in Germany, then you're going to have to be familiar with certain German phrases and things like that. You're going to have to be familiar with the times, and we'll get to that, so I'm talking ahead of myself. But I think one last thing that I want to mention, which is interesting, and I think which is also of great value when studying and reading the Bible, is what they call the appropriate sub-authority of tradition. The appropriate sub-authority of tradition. And that is the wisdom of the church through the centuries. Remember that the Christian religion stands on a certain history, and within that history, many people have thought about many things and has written many things about different Bible passages. And I think it would be irresponsible to ignore that and not even to pay attention to that. And that is why maybe reading good commentaries and things like that with Bible study is a good thing. So here is then a couple of principles that I think will serve you well when you want to read the Bible for all that it is worth. The first principle is to know about the original languages of the Bible. Now, to know about them, not to know them. Okay, there's a difference. So what I'm trying to say is it's not necessary for everyone who wants to study the Bible to master the ancient languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. But I do think that it will only help you if you put some effort into the basics of these languages. Now, the analogy that someone once used that I think is helpful here is it's like watching a rugby match in black and white, so there's no color. And if you want to make a judgment about something within the match, because there's no color, you can't the green field and the white line and the yellow ball or whatever, you can't make those kind of distinctions. It might sometimes be difficult to call the close ones, right? And just like that, although you can read the Bible, you can understand the essence of the gospel, you can arrive at good and correct interpretations of the Bible, the ancient languages might help you to call the close ones, if I can put it like that. This might include like something like doing a word study. For one example I can think of is the word world in the New Testament. In John 3 verse 16 we read, "For God so loved the world." And then in 1 John 2 verse 13, "Do not love the world or the things in the world." So God loves the world, but we should hate the world, or at least not love the world. So how do you make sense of that? A good word study on the word world, especially as it is used by the Apostle John in all his writings, will really help you to solve this, to answer some of the questions that you might have. Another principle is the historical cultural setting of the Bible. We must remember that the events in the Bible happened in against the backdrop of a certain historical context. Their language, their mode of communication, their understanding of the world around them, their manners and customs were all to some degree products of their culture. So consider, for example, the incident of the construction of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. And I think that on one level, the significance of the tower generally escapes the modern reader. By investigating the religious practices and beliefs, we can discover that it was generally held to be true that a person's God dwelled on a mountain. The mountain was symbolic of the separation between someone's God and himself or herself as a worshipper. And the gods were high and lifted up while the worshippers were on the ground below looking up towards the gods. And since there were no mountains here, as we can read in verse 2 of Genesis 11, in the plains of, I don't know how to pronounce this, but I think it's Shinar, indicates that people decided to construct a mountain where their gods can dwell. So that's another example, but where the historical context can help us to maybe open up something for you when you read the Bible. Another principle is literary genres of the Bible. And there is perhaps no more important principle in Bible study than understanding passages in their context. Many problems and errors crept into interpretations because the Bible was taken out of its proper context. But context, I think, is more than just reading the first couple of verses before a verse and the next couple of verses after the verse that you are trying to interpret. I think it also includes that to identify certain literary genres that you would find in the Bible. Because genres communicates in different ways. In the Bible, you have, for example, stories, letters, proverbs, poems, and prophecies, just to name a few. And there's a lot of poetry, as I said, there's poems as well. But for example, here with the genre, in order for you to understand a poem well, you have to understand what poetry entails. And the basic characteristics of Hebrew poetry is parallelism. A line of Hebrew poetry is usually made of two parts, and each part is called a colon. A colon may be a complete sentence or a phrase. Take Isaiah 1 verse 3, for example. We read there, "An ox knows its owner, and a donkey its master's manger. But Israel does not know. My people do not understand." Now, in your English Bible, this verse would probably occupy four lines, each phrase on its own line. But in the Hebrew Bible, it only occupies two lines. And not just that, what happens is the different words that's compared with each other in some way are above or below each other. So in the Hebrew Bible, on the first line, it would be, "An ox knows its owner, and a donkey its master's manger." And then on the second line, it will be, "Israel does not know, my people do not understand." So in this sense, an ox is parallel to Israel, and a donkey is parallel to my people. The question that must be asked is, how is an ox parallel to Israel? We've all heard the expression that you're as dumb as an ox. Now, the first colon of the first line tells us that an ox is not so dumb that it doesn't know its owner, all right? But Israel doesn't know her owner, who is God. So in that sense, Israel is dumber than an ox. So that's just an example of poetry that we find in the Old Testament. Now, the last principle I want to focus on, and then we can talk about some other important stuff, is called presuppositions or pre-understandings. Now, have you ever wondered why two people will arrive at two different interpretations of the same text or the same chapter or whatever, right? And the reason for that is that sometimes people have differences in their presuppositions or their pre-understandings, which they bring to the text. People from another culture, however, may not have the same understanding of the world as I have, or hold the same values that I hold. Some aspects of their understanding may be different from ours here in South Africa, which also definitely affects interpretation. A person's pre-understanding can be compared to a pair of glasses. So imagine someone looking through glasses at the world, and not just that, these glasses might be tinted with a specific color, like red, and therefore this person will see everything reddish, and that might be perfectly normal to him or her to see things in a reddish way. And so everything that we think about and learn about is filtered through these glasses to a certain extent. But now the question is, who's got the correct colored lenses, right? That's the question. Now, many people have concluded from this analogy that everybody has their own view of looking at things, and no other view is more legit than any other view or perspective that is out there because of their different colored glasses. So that would sort of preclude you from arriving at an objective view of something. And the term objective usually means that there is no bias or particular point of view that affects one's understanding of something. So when someone claims that no one can be objective, that person is actually assuming that his or her claim is true for everyone. A claim that is true for everyone is an objective claim. What this person is really saying, therefore, is it is objectively true that no one can be objective. Now, like I've pointed out earlier, a statement like this contradicts itself. On the one hand, if it is true that no one can be totally objective, then the person making this claim is also not totally objective. If the claim is not totally objective, then it doesn't apply to everyone, and we don't really need to pay attention to a claim like that. But I think the important thing to realize, however, is that we must be aware of our presuppositions, because we all have them. I'm not denying the fact that we have our presuppositions, we have our pre-understandings, but that makes it even more important for us to be aware of them, to identify them, and to know what they are, and so on. So the challenge for Bible readers on this level would be that that you have to identify your presuppositions which you bring to the text, but not to compromise on objective interpretation, because I think you can still arrive at objectivity in spite of that. And that would involve making a claim like having trans presuppositional truths, or, well, let's call it trans worldview truths. So it's truths that transcends your worldview, your colored lenses, right? There are these kind of truths that you would be able to have access to, doesn't matter what your presuppositions might be. But I think it's a lot easier said than done, so I don't want to overstate my case, but I do think that it's still possible to arrive at objectivity in spite of these presuppositions that we might have. So there's four principles that I've just identified. Now, I don't know what time it is, but I do want to end with one final thing. And I want to end with a portion from Scripture in Luke 24, verse 13 to 32. And there we are confronted with the two people. It's 3 days after the crucifixion of Jesus, and they're walking from Jerusalem to Emmaus, and they are talking and about all the events that they've experienced in Jerusalem the last couple of days surrounding the crucifixion of Jesus. And then the risen Jesus appears, or he is there with them. He walks with them. And then he also joins their conversation. And he said to them, this is Jesus, "What is this conversation that you're holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word, before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things happened. Moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning, and when they did not find his body, they came back saying that they had even seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but but him they did not see. And he said to them, 'O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken, was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?' And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them all the scriptures, the things concerning himself." Now it's interesting there, Jesus interpreted the scriptures to these two men. And then I think their reaction, because he departs from them, he disappears. But just before that, we also read earlier on that their eyes were somehow cloaked, that they could not recognize Jesus in their conversation. But then suddenly they recognized him. But then Jesus disappeared. And then we read their reaction. They say to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within as he talked to us on the road while he opened to us the scriptures?" So these guys had some sort of experience or some sort of encounter with the person of Jesus here. And part of this encounter was Jesus interpreting the scriptures to them. Now I think here I will add one more thing, but remember I'm getting this from this text, so I'm still applying all the other principles that I've already identified to reach this conclusion. But I want to just talk a little bit about this. Verse 27, if you consider that verse, and beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So what Jesus is actually saying here is everything in the Bible is about me. Beginning with Moses and the prophets, he said, it's all surrounding me. Now, if we think about the Bible, and we think that maybe it's about us, about what we must do and how we must live and how we have to do everything in order to get some sort of blessing, then of course we do not really need a savior. We do not really need someone who to save us, right? And all we need might just be a couple of rules that we need to live by. But there are basically two ways to read the Bible. We can read the Bible as if it's all about us and what we must do and what we have to run around doing in order to get the blessings. Or we can read every part of the Bible as if it's about Him, Jesus Christ, and what He has done for us. So either it's all about us or it's all about Him. Now, I want to end with this quote from Gerhardus. It's actually Gerhardus Vos. He was a Dutchman, but since we're talking English, Gerhardus Vos. And he said this about Jesus and the Bible. He said, whether we like it or not, criticism can touch the essence of our religion, which is Christianity. Because religion has become incarnate, and for our sakes had to become incarnate and make itself vulnerable in historic form. So this is a reference to Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, taking on flesh. As the Son of God, while on earth, had to expose Himself to the unbelief and scorn of men, so the word of the gospel could not be what it is for us unless it were subject to the same humiliation. Now, in the beginning, I referred to the Bible being strange and interesting and mysterious and all these things, but I think as a Christian, I would think that the Bible is much more than just that. It is the word of God. And therefore, we should, I think, when we read it carefully, read it responsibly, and read it also in community. Read it with other people, because it was never a book written for an individual reading it just by himself all the time. But read it for all that it is worth, because the worth that you'll find in there is meeting a person, and that person, as we saw in Luke, is Jesus Christ. The whole Bible spins around Him.